What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered the withdrawal of Russian forces from Syria as new UN-mediated peace talks on Syria get underway in Geneva. The Russian leader said the task before the armed forces has been largely completed and ordered them to begin a withdrawal of the main part of the force. Damascus says it agreed with the move, saying it was a coordinated action. The White House said President Obama spoke about the matter with his Russian counterpart. Josh Earnest is a presidential spokesman.
We have talked about how Russia's continued military intervention to prop up the Assad regime made the efforts to reach a political transition or to make a political transition even more difficult, that as long as Russia was aggressively weighing in militarily, they were removing at least part of the incentive for the regime to even engage in those kinds of conversations.
Meanwhile, Syrian proximity peace talks began Monday in Geneva. UN mediator Stefan de Mistura warned if the talks fail, a return to fighting is inevitable. Soldiers patrolled the empty beaches of the resort town of Grand Bassam in Ivory Coast Monday, a day after armed men launched an attack that killed 18, including 15 civilians and three soldiers. Foreign nationals, including four French citizens and a German woman, were among the dead. All three gunmen were killed. Al-Qaeda's North African affiliate, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, claimed responsibility for Sunday's attack, which targeted hotels. It follows similar deadly attacks on hotels in the capitals of Mali, Burkina Faso, last year. Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara declared 3 days of mourning. He addressed the nation Monday evening. This is VOA News. Turkey pointed Monday to two Kurdish rebels, a man and a woman, as likely responsible for the deadly suicide car bombing Sunday in Ankara that killed 35 people and wounded another 125. After visiting the wounded at an Ankara hospital, Turkey's Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu said there are very serious, almost certain findings that point to the separatist terrorist organization, referring to the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK. The Prime Minister said officials have detained 11 suspects accused of being directly linked to the bombing. U.S. UN Ambassador Samantha Power Monday said Tehran's missile launches last week were dangerous, destabilizing, and provocative, and undermined the prospect for peace in the region.
These were designed to be capable of delivering nuclear weapons. This merits a council response. Russia seems to be lawyering its way to look for reasons not to act, rather than stepping up and being prepared to shoulder our collective responsibility.
Washington says the launches violate language of a UN resolution adopted in July. Russian Ambassador Vitaly Churkin categorically ruled out new sanctions against Tehran, saying there was no legal violation of the Security Council resolution. Myanmar is set to get a new president Tuesday. The country's parliament will hold a historic vote to pick the new leader from a group of three candidates. The vote comes as the formerly army-ruled nation transitions toward its first civilian government in decades. Among the candidates is Tin Jaw, a childhood friend and longtime confidant of Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. The president is set to take office April 1st. Egypt Monday devalued its currency, the pound, to 8.85 to the dollar from 7.73 in an effort to ease a foreign exchange shortage that's hurting business activity. The central bank said it hopes to follow a more flexible approach to the exchange rate and rebuild foreign exchange reserves to about $25 billion from the current $16.5 billion. The Egyptian stock market soared nearly 7%, the biggest one-day boost since the ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi in mid-2013. The European Union has suspended direct financial aid to Burundi for ignoring human rights and failing to stop deadly political violence, sparked by last year's decision by President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to seek a controversial third term. Hundreds died, tens of thousands fled the violence. The Malawian government Monday destroyed more than 2.5 tons of ivory smuggled from Tanzania in a move aimed at combating poaching. Tanzania had obtained a three-month delay in carrying out the burning, arguing the ivory, worth some $3 million, should be preserved as evidence, but it did not seek a further delay. Malawi has another 4 tons to destroy. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Tuesday, March 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ivory Coast president declares his country will not be intimidated by terrorists.
A day after gunmen stormed a hotel and a beach in the seaside town of Grand Bassam, about 45 kilometers from the economical capital Abidjan, Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara solemnly addressed the nation Monday evening.
That's VOA reporter Emily Yop in Abidjan. Today is another day in the Ugandan Supreme Court where President Yoweri Museveni's re-election is being challenged. South Sudan's government is reducing its diplomatic staff in 32 countries. And Burundi says it is disappointed in the European Union for suspending aid to Burundi.
It is not up to the European Union or to any other partner to determine what is the course of a nation, be it Burundi, be it Rwanda, be it Congo, be it whichever country in Africa. It is up to the people of those countries to chart the path for themselves.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. Zimbabwe's newly launched political party is concerned about resurfacing of political violence in the country. And a young Sierra Leonean table tennis player eyes the 2016 Paralympics in Brazil. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Ivorian government announced a new death toll on Monday from Sunday's terrorist attack in Grand Bassam, declaring that 15 civilians were killed, as well as three members of the security forces and the three terrorists. As Emily Yop reports from Abidjan, President Alassane Ouattara later addressed the nation Monday evening.
There is the usual hustle and bustle on the street of Abidjan Monday, but the day is far from normal.
La psychose est installée. Elle est grande. On a même peur.
Abidjan resident Yuan Gui says psychosis has set in and is big. He says, we are scared that maybe they could come to Abidjan. One local headline calls it a bloodbath. Another simply reads, we are all Grand Bassam. The seaside town is just 50 kilometers outside Abidjan. Militant sect Hakim claimed the attack in a short message sent to a local Sahelian news site. For over a decade, Hakim has primarily operated for the north in the Sahara Desert. But West Africa has been on alert following recent attacks on upscale hotels in Bamako and Ouagadougou. The beach resorts of Grand Bassam are a popular relaxation spot for both expatriates and locals.
Le mode opératoire, on pense qu'il a changé. Il vise plus les Européens.
Abidjan resident Hugues Kwame says this group is not just targeting Westerners anymore, it's everybody. We are all concerned, he says. Of the 14 civilians killed, so far only two are confirmed to have been non-Ivorian. For many in Abidjan, the attack came as a shock, but not exactly a surprise.
C'est pas surprenant. Avec l'importance de la Côte d'Ivoire dans la sous-région économiquement et politiquement.
Local resident Adama Kone says it is not surprising given the political and economic importance of Ivory Coast in the region. He says we knew it was going to eventually happen, we just didn't know where or when. Street trader Roland Guina says more security is the answer.
Oui, ça a été renforcé, mais on veut qu'on renforce encore la sécurité plus.
Yes, he says, the state has already increased security, but we need more so it never happens again. Despite the fear, local resident Stéphane Tano says he will not change his lifestyle. He says, I'm not going to stop going to places where there are lots of people because we must live with this risk every day. Emily Yop from VOA News in Abidjan.
Burundi says it is disappointed in the European Union's decision to suspend some aid to the Burundian government. The EU on Monday postponed direct financial support for the Burundian government for not doing enough to find a political solution to the conflict that has so far claimed more than 400 lives since April last year. The EU said it blames President Pierre Nkurunziza's government for the surge in violence and the failure to protect human rights. But Burundian Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe says while his country needs assistance, the EU decision is a wake-up call to all developing countries to be self-reliant rather than depend on foreign aid. Nyamitwe says his government has been trying to address the situation and all it needed was some encouragement.
I believe that that decision was, in some ways, is not that negative. But of course, as a government, we were not happy because we believe that the government has not made any fault to begin with when it comes to the management of the situation on the ground. We are addressing the situation using the minimum means that are at our disposal, And we believe that all we needed was more of an encouragement, because our aim is to protect and to safeguard the interests of the people of Burundi.
What sort of encouragement do you need? I mean, it's been almost half a year since this crisis began, and nothing has been happening.
When you say nothing has been happening, what do you mean?
Well, I'm talking about the dialogue after the election. The so-called dialogue has been going nowhere.
Well, I think, again, the EU has been informed clearly that the government of Burundi cannot be blamed for what it has not done. If you say dialogue has not happened, what do you make of the inter-Burundian dialogue that is going on in the country?
But that is restrictive. I mean, you have put some restrictions on it.
Which ones?
The inter-Burundian dialogue.
Well, nobody has been excluded from it, except those who didn't want to participate. Again, I say it clearly, whoever wants to participate in that dialogue is most welcome. But inside the country, in the framework that has been provided, everybody is welcome, of course. But when it comes to the dialogue as happening outside the country, then it doesn't depend on the government of Burundi alone. It depends on the region, depends on other partners, depends on how things have been organized.
As you know, the European Union is blaming directly your president, President Pierre Nkurunziza, for the what they call the upsurge in violence. What can you say to that?
No, I think that is too much, because it is not up to the European Union or to any other partner to determine what is the course of a nation, be it Burundi, be it Rwanda, be it Congo, be it whichever country in Africa. It is up to the people of those countries to chart the path for themselves. Now, if we have gone through violence, then we need to sit down and find out what has happened. But the EU cannot decide, cannot determine, cannot say things happen this way because of ABCD. Then in that case, why do we need a dialogue for them?
Mr. Minister, you said your government, that the Burundian government has managed all along and can manage without this assistance that is being withdrawn. How do you develop the country if you don't get this kind of assistance?
Are you suggesting that other countries of the world get assistance to assist their own people?
But let me put it the other way. Can you go ahead with meaningful development programs without this assistance?
I think so. You know, we don't take the assistance as the lifeblood of Burundi. I mean, if we don't have that assistance, are we going to stop breathing just because we didn't get the support? I mean, we will be glad to receive it, but if we don't receive it, we will absolutely develop resilience. You know, we have to be self-reliant. I believe that this decision of today actually comes as a wake-up call, not only to Burundi, but also to everybody, to all the countries, developing world in general, to, you know, start sustaining themselves, you know, relying on themselves rather than on foreign aid. Because if, you know, foreign aid doesn't develop any country, that is a fact.
Ali Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the Belgian capital, Brussels. In Uganda, lawyers challenging the re-election of President Yoweri Museveni in the country's Supreme Court are back in court today for another day of testimonies. The lawsuit is brought by former Ugandan Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi, who wants the court to order a recount in 45 districts because, had the votes in those districts not been tampered with, President Museveni would not have won 60% of the vote as announced by the Electoral Commission. Journalist Isaac Imaka, political reporter for the Uganda Daily Monitor newspaper, has been covering the proceedings at the High Court. He says Electoral Commission Chair Badru Chigundu told the court yesterday that he did not know the number of voters who were verified to vote by the biometric machines because the equipment was not programmed to release data immediately.
Of course, he had so many questions were asked to him, but two or three things stood out. The question on whether he knew how many people were verified or voted through the biometric voter verification machine, and he said he did not know. He did not, because he said that the machines are not yet back at the station for them to retrieve all the data. He said that the machines were not programmed to release numbers of voters verified by the machines immediately. And that basically was the crux of one of the points in the petition, because the moment people wanted to basically juxtapose or retrieve the data from these machines and demonstrate that the results that were announced by the Electoral Commission do not match that information in the machines. So by saying that he cannot avail these machines, he's basically saying that, hey guys, you cannot actually extract information from the machine, so you cannot demonstrate that what I announced is different.
You mentioned two things. The second one was what? The so-called DR forms, is that correct?
The declaration of of result from now. Amao Mabawazi's team had wanted to show or to demonstrate that the results that were published on the website, or the Electoral Commission website, do not match some of the results on the DR forms. Now, last week, court ruled that the Electoral Commission should avail all DR forms from around the country to the Amama team, which they did. Now, today, Amama's lawyer came with a copy of the declaration of result form, which he wanted to show or tell before court to demonstrate that what was on that form did not match or does not match what is on the website or the results that were announced by the Electoral Commission. But that form was rejected on the point that the court could not verify its authenticity. Why? Because that form, which had results of a polling station called Kano Primary School in Wakiso, Mr. Mbabaz did not have a polling agent at that polling station. So the question was to the lawyers, how then did you access that copy of the year form if you did not have a polling agent? The lawyer said some of our people are chased away from the polling station and they managed to get the year form in their own way.
Isaac, what's next? When is the next court day?
Court is going to go on for the next around 16 days and there'll be judgment by 31st of this month.
Isaac Emeka is the political reporter for Uganda's Daily Monitor newspaper. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Today is Tuesday, March 15th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. South Sudan's foreign minister says his country is reducing the number of diplomats in 32 South Sudan embassies around the world. Barnaba Marao Benjamin says the country has not been able to pay its diplomats since December last year. He says the Ministry of Finance and the Bank of South Sudan are working to send the salaries of South Sudanese diplomats and other local support staff who work in the country's foreign mission. Marao denied that South Sudanese in Ghana, Egypt, and Zimbabwe have received notices to vacate the embassy buildings due to failure to pay rent.
What is happening, of course, we have had some delays in some payments towards rent, that is true. But what we are doing because of the economic crisis is that we are reducing the number of staff in our embassies to cut down on the costs. I think that's what is happening, but we are not closing any embassies. What we are doing is to reduce the number of officials in some of the embassies where we have very big numbers so that we can also save some money and be able to keep the upkeep of the rest of the embassies.
How many South Sudanese embassies are out there in the world?
Oh, in the world, we have, frankly, about 32 embassies, which is quite a big number. And that's why we have to cut down the staff in some of these embassies.
We have news from Cairo saying that your embassy there got an eviction notice because they have not been able to pay rent.
No, I think that is a bit of exaggeration. There is no issue of eviction, really. Because the delay for reasons when things are being put right and corrected, I think cannot lead to that. I think there is a bit more of a exaggeration on that. But that we have some economic problems, that is true, and that's why we have decided that we have to reduce the number of officials in some of those embassies, including the Cairo embassy. We are also going to cut that. We have also cut down on the number of people who will remain in the embassy there.
And how about Accra and Harare? We also hear that your embassies in these two countries are going through a tough time.
Accra and Harare, I think they are going on all right. There was a delay, but we resolved some of that problem. In Accra, I think they had the problem in the building because the building, part of the building got burnt. I think that's why they had a crisis. It was a local fault, I think, the building where they were.
When I spoke to some diplomats, they told me that they have not received their salaries for 4 consecutive months. What are you going to do with your diplomats who have not received their salaries for 4 months?
No, they should receive their salaries, and that's what the government is trying to do now, so that they receive their salaries as soon as possible, and that both the Minister of Finance and the Central Bank are working on that in order to remit their salaries.
So we are talking about next week? Are we talking about any time frame?
Well, I'm talking of a time frame. It has to be done as soon as possible. Next week, they should be receiving their salaries, yes.
The South Sudan Foreign Minister Barnaba Marao Benjamin, he was speaking with John Tanza of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program. In Zimbabwe, the newly launched Zimbabwe People First Party, led by former Vice President Joyce Mujuru, says it is disturbed by the resurfacing of political violence in the country after its rally in Harare's Glenview suburb over the weekend was disrupted by suspected ZANU-PF youths. This comes barely a week after Movement for Democratic Change youths were also attacked by suspected ZANU-PF members in two suburbs of the capital. Acting Zimbabwe People First Party spokesperson Rugeri Gombo says his party condemns all forms of violence.
It was unfortunate in the sense that we are a peaceful organization. We always preach peace and we want things to be done in an orderly fashion. We don't expect to have any organization, be it ZANU, MDC or so, attacking us, because we always believe that the solution to Zimbabwe's problem is not in mounting violence, intimidation, threats, and so on. The solution is to discuss amongst ourselves how best we can acquit ourselves in the light of the terrible situation that we are facing.
When you were still part of ZANU-PF, opposition parties used to accuse ZANU-PF of violence, but you were dismissing those allegations. What are you saying now, after your members were allegedly attacked by the same party that you used to defend?
The situation depends on the kind of reports that you get. Sometimes when you are right up there, you are not given the correct information. Of course, there are cases where we saw MDC people being beaten up, which didn't augur well. But now that we are out, we can see the mistakes that happened.
That was Rugeri Gombo, interim spokesperson for the newly launched opposition Zimbabwe People First Party. He was speaking with Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe program. A 26-year-old table tennis champion in Sierra Leone is hoping to go to Brazil for the 2016 Paralympics. He has already won several international medals despite being paralyzed by polio as a child. Nina DeVries has more from Freetown.
George Windham is a force to be reckoned with. He's been playing table tennis for 14 years and is among the best physically challenged table tennis players in Africa.
Whenever I'm playing table tennis, it always makes me happy. It always makes me forget about my disability.
He says having polio has pushed him even harder to make something of his life. He says there's not much support for disabled people in Sierra Leone. Having an outlet like table tennis is a way to bring them confidence.
I feel good because for the past something like 13 years, I was alone. The only disabled in the country, I was playing table tennis. But for the past 4 to 5 months now, I have something like 4 or 5 other disabled that are training table tennis. So it's a big boost for me, and I'm very proud of that.
Windham's coach, Ibrahim Kamara, agrees. He's with the Sierra Leone Table Tennis Association and says they're looking at ways to engage more youth in table tennis, including those with disabilities. He adds Windham can be an inspiration to others.
George has a natural talent and is unique on his speed and control, which is very difficult for somebody sitting on a wheelchair. Speed and control is mostly for standing players, but somebody on a wheelchair with speed and control, that is natural talent.
Windham still has many challenges, such as money for training. There has been a bit of help from local sports committees and local fundraising has been done, but more is needed.
Presently, I'm straining. I don't have that facility. I don't have that encouragement, and I'm not preparing for the Paralympic Games in Brazil. By now, I should have been in a training camp training, because other athletes from other countries are now training. But I'm still here in my country training. I need to go out to train to prepare myself very well, but there is no sponsor.
According to his coach, Kamara, around $5,000 more is needed just for training opportunities to gear up for the big event in Brazil. For now, Windham says he will just continue doing what he can to get by and hopefully represent his country later this year. He also hopes he can continue inspiring others. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour, and here is Marco Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, with the rest of Daybreak Africa Sports. Good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with athletics. Kenya's Solomon Kirwa triumphed in a lifetime best and course record of 58 minutes and 44 seconds at the Rome to Ostia half marathon in the Italian capital Rome on Sunday. Besides, Kirwa ran the world's quickest half marathon this year and the fourth fastest of all time. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's Woknesh Degefa prevailed in the women's race in 1 hour, 7 minutes and 8 seconds. In Spain, Kenyan Valerie Aibey clocked 2 hours, 25 minutes and 26 seconds to set a women's course record at the Barcelona Marathon on Sunday. Ethiopian Dino Sefir triumphed in the men's race in 2 hours, 9 minutes and 31 seconds. Turning to rugby, New Zealand edged South Africa 19-14 in the IRB Sevens Series final in Vancouver, Canada on Sunday. Russia outclassed Kenya 24-7 in the semifinal of the Shield category. At the end of the sixth leg of the 10-leg series, South Africa is second in the overall standings with 105 points. Kenya is eighth with 53 points, while Zimbabwe is 17th with 1 point. In Olympic news, African champions Nigeria are drawn in Group B with Argentina, hosts Brazil, Lithuania, Spain, and one more team yet to qualify for the men's basketball contest at the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro. According to the draws conducted in Rio de Janeiro on Friday, Africa women's basketball champions Senegal are in Group B with Canada, Serbia, the United States of America, and two more teams yet to qualify. Staying with Olympic basketball, Angola, Senegal, and Tunisia are among 18 teams vying for the final three spots in the men's Olympic basketball event. The tournament runs simultaneously in Serbia, the Philippines, and Italy from the 4th to the 10th of July. Angola is drawn in their preliminaries with Serbia and Puerto Rico in the Serbian capital, Belgrade. Senegal face Canada and Turkey in the Philippines' capital, Manila, while Tunisia encounter Croatia and hosts Italy in Turin. Meanwhile, Cameroon and Nigeria get a last chance to qualify for the women's Olympic basketball event during a contest in the French city of Nates from the 13th to 19th of June. Cameroon is drawn with Argentina and Turkey in their preliminaries, while Nigeria is up against Belarus and South Korea. The 12 nations are vying for 5 spots up for grabs to the Olympics. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, March 15th.
Nigerians, let's all put our hands on deck and rescue our destiny. It's now we are truly in a transformation born out of a political revolution. Reform is in process. It's like being in a dark tunnel, rough, tough, and hard. But remember that after the dark tunnel comes light. Corruption and impunity ate deep into us. But with all hands on deck, Nigeria will sail through. And we will smile again. I am Okechukwu Ajaka of Ezelisa family on the Chato Kingdom, Anambra State, southeast of Nigeria. Thank you, VOA.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Soldiers patrolled the empty beaches of a resort town in Ivory Coast on Monday, one day after armed men launched an attack, killing 18 people. That's it for this Tuesday, March 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Michael Woman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We will discuss the World Bank Conference on Land and Poverty. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa, Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Do you love sports? VOA Africa has more of what you love, an expanded Sunny Side of Sports show. More on-the-scene reports and analysis, plus what's trending in the sports world. Come to VOA Africa for the expanded half hour of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Remember, tune in starting Monday, March 21st, right here on VOA Africa.